Hi! Thanks for tuning in. This episode is supposed to be about the amazing graphic novel Beetle and the Hollow Bones by Eliza Lane, but we got distracted approximately 18 times. Regardless, spoiler alert for the comic, we do discuss it and talk about the ending, so please make sure to read it beforehand because it is wonderful, and I strongly believe that you should experience all the fun stuff for yourself.
Welcome to In Media Les, a podcast where we discuss our favorite queer relationships in media. I'm Chloe.
And I'm Val.
And today we will be discussing Beetle and the Hollow Bones, which is a graphic novel by Eliza Lane. It's a YA novel following a goblin witch apprentice by the name of Beetle as she tries to solve the mystery of her friend Blob Ghost, who's stuck in a mall, as her old friend Cat, who went away to like Hogwarts or something, returns home and they reconnect. And so the central romance is between Cat and Beetle, you know, finding out why Blob Ghost can't leave the mall is kind of the central kind of like plot driver of the story. Anyway, yeah. I just read it for the first time, actually, this morning, because we were going to record this episode. I really enjoyed it. It's so cute. The art is so well done. In particular, the use of color.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have anything, but like, I was just noticing, like, Eliza is so good at, like, setting up these pages so that, like, I don't know, just the emotion shows through the color so well. Like, there's pages where two characters are fighting, and you can see the, like, color drain as they're more and more upset with each other, which is interesting because you would think it would turn red, but it's actually more just that they're, like, being emotionally distant, and so the mm-hmm. color turns, like, gray, and it's almost like the panels are, like, grayscale for a little while. And then, like, when characters are more in touch with their emotions, there's, like, bursts of color, and that was the thing that, like, really stood out to me.
I really like that, too. I also think that, like, I'm always a fan of kind of the pastel color palette.
Those blues and oranges and purples. Just, it's very watercolor-y.
Yeah, it's not muted, but it's very subtle and gentle.
Yes.
And also, the artist used kind of like the spaces in between the panels, you know, that usually in classic comics they tend to be just white borders, right?
Yeah.
In this one, it's kind of like colored in and matches the mood of everything.
Yeah, I guess you would call those margins.
Yes. Let's say yes.
If you are a comics person and know that there's like a term for like the space between panels, please let us know. We're idiots.
What's the panel space, guys?
I'm sure I could probably Google it, but
where's the fun in that?
What is the space between panels in comics called?
It's called transition space between
and gutters. Panels. Gutter. The gutter is the space between two panels.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
Yeah. Except in this work where there is stuff to look at in the gutters.
Get your mind into the gutter.
That's our podcast tagline. Get your mind into the gutter with In Media Les.
Absolutely. But yeah, like, just the coloring and the shading, everything is just such a gentle style, and the colors are so very easy on the eye, but you can see that there's a lot of color theory in here. I just love comic books. I kind of have a question for you.
Yes.
Would you say this comic book is more geared towards a much younger audience, or are we kind of the intended audience for this sort of graphic novel?
That is a good question. So I think that is a question that I kind of grappled with as I read it, because I don't know. It just, this is not, you know, going to break your brain. I think the narrative pretty much goes the way you imagine it will the moment you kind of meet everyone. And so in that sense, it is very YA, like, but that doesn't have to be the case, right? And, like, I don't want to dismiss YA, because I've read some YA that is really interesting and innovative, so I don't want to sound like I'm insulting YA. But on the other hand, like, there are some, like, jokes that seem to be very, like, I don't know, I was, like, thinking, like, this feels like a lot of, like, millennial humor.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, like, I don't know. It would be interesting to give this to, like, a 12-year-old and see what their thoughts are.
Yeah. I think a lot of recent comic books kind of have that sort of vibe to it, especially, so this one is queer.
Yes. And it's explicitly, like, it's published by what, like, Stonewall Press or something? It was something like that. Or it was some kind of imprint where it was specific.
Well, it's Simon and Schuster.
Simon and Schuster. It won a Stonewall honor.
Yeah. And there's a lot of these types of graphic novels out there. They all have this similar vibe, right? Yeah. Where it's these two characters. They are reunited, or they become fast friends, and then they go on a journey that's fairly tropey and not revolutionary by any form of, like, writing. It's not gonna change the way comics work. But because I think of the simplicity of the plot lines, we get to experience these characters in depth much, much more than what I guess I would call, like, traditional literature or like comics from Marvel from, like, 30 years ago.
Right? So you're saying it's, like, character-driven, not story-driven, in short.
Yes. But at the same time, it cannot function without that plot.
I mean, that's true. Although something that just came to my mind as you were kind of describing the bare bones plot, it's also very similar to Life is Strange.
Yeah, there's, like, a thing happening and you're actively participating in that plot line. But the only reason you care about it is because you're growing to really like the characters, right?
Yeah.
For example, we discussed Baru in a previous episode, right? A couple of episodes ago or something. And people who do not like Baru, they will not finish that book. They will not. You have to love the main character to finish a book like that.
Because you spend so much time inhabiting her head.
Yes. Books like Gideon or Harrow, right? In those books, there's a plot line happening. Like in Gideon, yes, we are actively trapped in this house and things are happening and people are trying to figure out whatever the puzzle is, or you know what I mean, like, there is a plot. But yeah, when I think of that book, I'm not thinking of what happened in it in terms of plot. I'm thinking about how Gideon reacted to all of these outside influences, right?
So it's like it's character centric. The plot revolves around the character. The characters don't revolve around the plot.
Exactly. And if I'm reading like a 1984, for example, right? That's all plot for the most part, even though it is a character study. I care more about what's happening in the book than I do about Winston.
Yeah, like you can describe a lot more of the plot of 1984 than you can tell, like, characteristics about Winston beyond the fact that, like,
that he's stressed out.
That he's stressed out. He has an ulcer. He's rebellious in his head. I don't know. Like, yeah. It's very basic. Whereas I see what you're saying. Like, and then compare that to here, where you could probably say a lot about Kat, you know, who's not even in that much of it, but you can tell she's really conflicted about, like, her loyalty to her aunt versus her friendship or budding relationship with Beetle. And Beetle, on the same token, you know, you can say a lot about her. Even the ghost, Blob Ghost,
Blob.
Penny, spoilers, Penny.
How can you spoil it? Oh, my God.
Oh, gosh. On the show where we discuss them,
we don't have spoiler tags in the first 5 seconds.
Oops.
Yeah, and you kind of mentioned how, wow, just lost that thought immediately.
We're just like losing, it's just a weird time to be recording. I feel like this is like the time of day where I'm usually like wrapping up work and therefore usually going to my sofa to like veg for a little bit before I make dinner. And so like, this is like a weird time to be recording.
Yeah, it's like the in-between of productivity. Yes. Okay, I figured it out.
Okay.
So you kind of mentioned that it has this millennial feel to it. And that's one of the things I think that these comics have in common. It's that I feel like a lot of these people, these artists and authors and creators, are people who exist in fandom and use that sort of shorthand to create stories that people who also exist in fandom would really enjoy and are familiar with.
It's kind of like the Tumblr culture storytelling.
Yeah.
But which, again, sounds dismissive, but no, I mean, I really enjoy it. Like, mm-hmm. It's a very, and you're right, there's kind of a common through line. There's a lot of that kind of like, not quite internet humor, not quite to the level that Gideon the Ninth gets to, where it's like the author literally putting memes from the internet in the book. Like, this doesn't, you know, like quite get to that, but it definitely has that internet, Twitter, Tumblr sense of humor to a lot of the character and how Beetle like interacts with the world.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's just so very similar to a lot of these graphic novels. For example, there's one called Mooncakes that I read that's really good.
Mooncakes,
yeah.
What is it about?
It's about a werewolf lady and her childhood friend. I read it a while ago.
Is a novel or graphic novel?
It's a graphic novel.
There's a witch, yeah, and there's a woman with, like, dog ears.
Yes.
By Wendy Hsu and Suzanne Walker?
I believe so, yeah. Okay. And then there's Witch Boy, which is a very similar kind of style. There's a magic boy. His friend is this tomboyish young girl, and they go on an adventure together. And all of these sort of graphic novels have a very, very similar structure. And right. We even discussed it in our She-Ra episode near the end there. Stevenson and their spouse created several of these graphic novels. And it feels like a lot of these creators and artists exist in very similar spaces. I don't know, like, I never get tired of reading these sort of stories, even though if we break them down, they're ultimately pretty much identical in the sense of storytelling, right? These two people come together and they form a bond and they solve a really, really big problem in their surroundings and environment that affects their family or themselves very personally. Like, that's it. That's the whole story. But I don't know. Like, it's so fun to read them.
I mean, they're kind of like candy. Like, there's not anything in here that's going to fill you up and make you like sit back and like consider your place in the universe. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm quoting Zuko there. I think there's some point in...
I will not anyway, be the Iroh to your Zuko.
No, it's the part where he gets stuck with Aang in the dragon place.
Silver lining.
In the glue, and he says... And they're stuck, and he says, "What?" And Aang says, "What do we do now?" And Zuko says, like, I don't know, consider our place in the universe. But anyways... This is just digression the episode. What am I trying to say here? I'm trying to say, like, it's not like, yeah, making you reconsider what your place is in the world, but you sit there and you read it and you enjoy it and you have a good time. It's beautiful. It's fun to look at. And I don't know, there's some depth and characterization to it. I do like the fact that, like, there is kind of one, like, villainous villain, mm-hmm. the aunt.
Yeah.
But by and large, most of the people are just people. Like, there's that funny part where they encounter the custodian. Whose name I forget.
Yeah, and she's very, like, friendly, but also kind of like, I'm just a janitor here. Just go about your business and I'll go about mine. Be careful, kids.
She says something funny like, don't get caught by someone less nice than me, or like yeah. something like that. And it's, that was very good. What was her name? I want to say it was like Charlotte. No,
it's something very silly and out of place.
Oh my God. I'm going to bug myself.
Let's take a moment to find it.
And the one thing, I got it in digital. This really feels like a book that you should get the paper version, by the way.
Yeah.
Don't do what I did.
Yeah.
Get the paper version. I read it on my laptop, and it was not bad. You know, and there are some books that you can totally, like some graphic novels you can totally get away with reading on a screen, especially, you know, like a lot of like web comics and whatnot are meant for that. But like, this is clearly meant for paper.
Mm-hmm. The custodian's name is Hester.
Hester. That's such a good name, too.
Very good name.
I'm going to name my next character Hester.
It's like it is. Hester, it's such a good
Hester
name.
Hester Prynne? Is that the character from Scarlet Letter? Oh, God. I go on another tangent.
I think so. But yeah, like, there is a lot of characterization for like, tertiary characters that happens very, very quickly.
Yes.
For example, what was that? The Worm, who's the business owner, who they're kind of like running away from.
Worm of Endearment.
Yeah.
Is what the name of the store was, at least.
And I have no idea what that store is about or why that worm is like not happy with Beetle. But there's so much just in that, those couple of panels that's like, they're running away and Beetle is like, uh-oh, I cannot be seen here. It's like, it's a store, right? So you would theoretically think that it'll be a place that you can walk into.
The impression I got was that the worm is just very overbearing because it's the Worm of Endearment. But maybe I'm just reading into it.
It's quite possible. Also, isn't her secret lair like through the back storage room of that place or
yes.
something? So she's trespassing. There's, but yeah, like it's that sort of thing. There's a bunch happening all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's so subtle. And if you miss it, it's completely fine. But at the same time, it's still there. For example, the grandmother. She has a team of adventurers that she used to go around with when she was younger. And all of them look so distinguished. And they all look like a D&D party. And it's hilarious when we find out that she's actually like a retired adventurer that is legitimately super powerful, but she's retired, so she's not gonna like do all that crazy stuff she did in her childhood or adulthood. It's like these sort of little things that really get to me, and I think that's what makes it feel so very millennial, is because there's a lot of like these little inside jokes that it's not directly D&D, right? But you can see that the author is in some cases inspired slightly by that sort of role play.
Possibly
plays it or maybe engages in other media that does that sort of thing. But there's a lot of these little things throughout.
So I guess my question for you, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, because we're talking at length about how it's informed by like this, you know, certain culture. Do you think that makes it more inaccessible to people who aren't as familiar with that culture? Because I feel like, you know, there's a lot of through lines here if you look at like Adventure Time or Steven Universe or Lumberjanes or, you know, any of these books that kind of have a very similar vibe, kind of cater towards a similar audience. Do you think that makes this work less accessible?
I honestly believe that it's like that on purpose, and it's not because it's trying to keep people out, but it's because it's made to a very specific group of people, and it's not necessarily age-restricted, but it is kind of like, this is not a famous graphic novel, right? Like, when I told you about it, you really had no idea what I was talking about.
I had never heard of it, no.
So it's not very big. If you mentioned Gideon the Ninth, in a lot of circles, people are going to be like, oh yeah, I've heard of it, if not read it. But it's still not going to be everyone, right? Because it is a YA, so it's restrictive in that way. People tend to stick in the same kind of sphere of influence when they're consuming their media.
Yeah.
I think that this book and books like these are created for this specific audience because that's how they can exist.
What does that mean?
I think, so I don't know how publishing houses really work, but if I were to go and try to sell this book, it'd be very difficult for me to kind of sell it as something other than a slice of life comic with a fairly diluted plot, right?
Right.
It's not that exciting in some sense. But because of the other graphic novels that are very similar that exist, I think there's a consistency there that the same people who consume those other graphic novels... What is that one? There's one that's called something like The Princess and the Dressmaker? The Prince and the Dressmaker? It's that one, for example, is a slightly more popular yes. graphic novel. But it's still in a very similar vein of storytelling, and there's queerness in it, right? So catering to the audience that would read graphic novels like that, if I was a publisher, I would say, yeah, this is a safe bet for a very specific niche kind of audience. Because, I don't know, like, I have 6 or 7 of these types of books behind me on my shelf right now, right? And whenever one comes out, I don't really look at the summary or at the author's other works. Just the way it is printed and, like, the art styles, like, the coloring, all of those things kind of very quickly dictate to me that this is a similar type of story that I'm used to in that type of graphic novel. So for me, I will just get that comic. So this comic is similar enough to other comics like that, that there's gonna be a specific audience that will go for it. I don't think it's meant to invite people in. Maybe young kids who are just like, you know, questioning things, or maybe are not questioning things and just want content for themselves that is similar to how they present or how they feel. But in terms of like, outsiders who may not be queer, I don't think there's any gatekeeping here, but it's definitely not intended to invite, I don't want to say outsiders, but that's kind of the word that I have for it, to invite this like outside crowd in.
Right. Okay.
That was a very long-winded explanation of a point. It could have made in like 2 sentences, but hey, the more words, the better.
Yeah, that's the podcast. If you wanted just 2 sentences, you would check Twitter.
Exactly. By the way, check our Twitter.
Check our Twitter. Yeah. We don't have 2 sentences on there, but we do have posts.
Exactly.
What? What is going on?
We're loosey-goosey today. It's okay. When I was reading this, right, I'm still kind of going off of that, like, topic of authors who create this.
She's on her soapbox.
I'm
here
on
she
that
goes.
Soapbox, and I'm not getting off. But the authors that kind of create within a fandom, Beetle and Cat, they remind me of so many other queer couples that a lot of them who we've talked about already.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Chloe and Max, or the, I don't know, it's very similar to a lot of those, the Kurosami,
yeah,
the, I don't know, just
Vi and Caitlin.
Yeah, Vi There's and Caitlin's a really good one.
Luz and Amity.
I would like to see some, like, different couples, like, there's a lot of different ways to have a relationship with someone, and it doesn't have to be, oh, we were best friends in childhood, and then we had a falling out, and now we're going to fall in love. Like, I get why that's a very common trope, because, I don't know, it just, it's easy, it creates tension. I'd like to see some more diversity, I guess, in terms of how we present, how people end up meeting and becoming involved in a relationship in queer media, because I feel like that one is just so common.
I agree with you. However, I wouldn't put it on authors of works that are as small and contained as these.
Yeah, because I'm not. Yeah. I'm not targeting them in particular. And like, I know we're doing it in the context of Beetle and the Hollow Bones. So like, I don't want to seem like I'm attacking this work in particular, because it is not, you know, it is not one work. And I don't have a problem with this. Like, I enjoyed it. It's just writ large. It just feels like this is every work.
I've been actually thinking about this a lot lately. And I know that we've discussed it several times throughout the podcast where, you know, there's always the non-binary character who's not human.
Yeah.
Or there's always...
Yeah, like the non-binary character being like non-human is so common. And it's, again, like it kind of makes sense on some level. Like it's probably easier for a publisher. It's less controversial to be like, you know, the weird kind of not humanoid character uses they them, like that's easy. But and I can see like a publisher being like, that's more acceptable to show to 12-year-olds, but like I don't know, it again, it's just I wish people would try other things.
I think it has a lot to do with not only like editors and publishers and kind of that sort of, I wouldn't call it policing, but kind of gatekeeping in a way. I think it also has to do with, like, how human brains work. It's very easy for us to stay in the same pattern, right?
Right.
For example, it's one of those things that when you start watching a show and you see two women have chemistry, it's almost always because they exhibit some sort of behavior from a trope, right?
Yeah.
And that's easy for us to latch onto. I am so, so very certain that there's a lot of works out there that do non-binary representation really well. But I think because they don't fit that sort of pattern that we can just latch onto it and understand exactly what kind of character they are, that people seek it out, and therefore I think it just doesn't get traction. And I think a lot of these sort of works kind of quietly fade away because of that. And there's no real way to fix it until big publishers start taking these sort of risks and advertising these works just as well as they would advertise a book like Gideon.
Yeah.
Right? Gideon was everywhere. Any bookstore I went into when it was released, I was always staring at that redhead.
It became like a phenomenon very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I will say, like, we do have a small platform. So if you do know a good work with, like, some very interesting non-binary characters, please let us know.
Yes.
Because we will be happy to feature it on the podcast and maybe give it a little attention.
I bet it's not even, like, that difficult to find those works if we actually actively look for them. But you have to know a place to start looking for them, right?
Yeah.
And I personally don't even know how to start that, because a lot of the spaces where content is created is operated on tropes, and that's what gets smaller artists those views, those retweets, reblogs, you know, people engage with that sort of content much more readily. So I understand why smaller artists would go for that sort of art. Or yeah. Would be comfortable with that art. Even like, you know, anyone who's ever tried to draw, I feel like every single one of us always started with that like profile face. And then once we move on from that profile face of a character, we'd move on to like that 3/4 perspective, not perspective, but view, right?
Right.
And it's just something that most artists kind of learn from and go to, because those sort of things are easy to draw. That's why we don't see a lot of art where there are people who are obese, right? That's why we don't see a lot of art that has that sort of minutia that certain ethnic groups have. And I'm not saying specific ethnic groups, but like almost every person is a part of some sort of ethnic group that is not depicted. Because there is minutia that, for many groups, there's, like, history that makes that sort of art very criticized and scrutinized. So artists fear depicting certain, like, art styles because it might get taken the wrong way or be used in the wrong way.
Right.
And there's social context for it. But also, it's just something that takes a lot of effort. And not everyone is going to go for it. So I understand why artists like these go for the general, least invasive sort of art structure. And that's fine for small artists. Like, I respect that. That's okay. But I feel like we're seeing more and more of that in bigger publishers. Image Comics has a lot of diverse characters, right? All of their comics have some sort of queerness or minority groups as main characters. There's a lot of conflicts that have to do with that sort of stuff. And it's great. And I don't think I've ever seen that before in other comics. I haven't really seen it in Marvel or DC, even though I wasn't like an avid reader. But that's not what the most popular comics have for those two publishers.
It's always funny to me, speaking of, sorry, that like Image right now does so many cool things with a lot of like, yeah, queer characters and more like diverse representation, because it was founded by a bunch of white dudes, and one of them was Rob Liefeld, who's just like the most infamous, like, he like was famous for drawing very beefy, like, masculine bros. Google like Rob Liefeld art sometime.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so funny that, like, yeah, he's one of the founders of Image, because like all his characters are just the most muscular dudes. Like, they, at a certain point, it's like bordering on parody how muscular he draws every single person.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite artists is, I do not know how to pronounce his last name, so I apologize, but Brian K. Oh, God.
Vaughn?
Vaughn, thank you.
It's either going to be very simple, or we're going to be big idiots, and mm-hmm. it's just like, yeah, it's just Vaughn, or it's going to be something like Vaughn. God, I don't know. We're sticking with Vaughn. We're sorry if it isn't. We know there's another A in there. We're just dumb.
Look, as a person with a very long last name, I understand the plight and challenges, and
yeah,
he'll be okay. I have a last name
that no one can pronounce, so I know how it goes.
But yeah, he makes really, really good comics. You know, he's just some white guy. I'm fine with that, right? Because we're getting really, really good content. It's nuanced. There's respect when it comes to certain people and certain characters and certain tropes. And we kind of have this sort of thing in a lot of comic books right now, but it's still fairly difficult to leave tropes behind and use new ones that are less common. Right, so
yeah,
kind of to get back on topic.
Okay, we've gone so wandered.
It's okay. I think this is like a good conversation to have, and
we need to be like Penny and get trapped somewhere. Like, someone needs to put boundaries on us at some point.
Can someone curse us real quick?
Yes, wizard TikTok, witch TikTok, get on that.
That was the youngest thing I've ever heard you say.
What?
That was like such a Gen Z sentence. Beautiful.
I'm around on the internet. You make it sound like I'm a million years old.
No.
Jesus.
I would never have said that because I didn't know there was a witch part of TikTok.
Yeah. Remember cool. The whole hexing the moon thing?
That makes a lot of sense.
Where it was like all those young witches wanted to hex the moon, and people were like, yo, young witches, don't hex the moon. That's really dangerous. You know, the moon is a very powerful source of magical energy, and hexing it could have dire consequences. And I was just watching this, and I was like, I have literally no stake in this game. And so this is very fun to watch.
Well, that does sound excellent.
But I'm glad the moon was not hexed, because or maybe the moon was hexed, and that's why everything has gone wrong.
Yeah. UA just got super upset And she was like, guys.
That is like our fourth Avatar joke of the podcast. So
that's a quarter of my personality. So
that's true. I've seen her desk. Korra is on it.
And I have a Naga plushie, and I don't even have plushies.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I'm looking at Max and Chloe on the corner of my desk. So
I only have soft bricks on my desk.
And, yeah, it's true.
And a Naga.
So anyway, our podcast that we were recording an episode about Beetle and the Hollow Bones.
Okay, in terms of plot, right, I actually really like that they had an argument. I don't know why, but that always gets me. I love when characters, like, have an argument, and then they realize how much they miss each other and kind of, like, how much it sucks to not hang out together.
I did like in the argument, too, that, like, it didn't end with, like, one hurting the other and it just, like, ending. It was more like Beetle, like, stood her ground and was like, if you end up like your aunt and you're a big petty tyrant, then I'm going to stop you. And it was just so cool that, like, even though it was clearly, like, Cat, you know, kind of, like,
Lashing out.
Like, Beetle didn't just stand her ground, but, like, got the upper hand. And I love that panel because, like, it shows Beetle as, like, towering over Cat.
Yes.
And it's such a well-done panel and just such a much more interesting argument because, you know, usually when this happens, like, I don't know, like, it would have been very easy for Cat to just, like, call Beetle a bunch of names, and then Beetle runs off and is sad. And But Beetle stood her ground, and I really appreciated that.
Yes. It really was, like, such a unique argument. And also, when you consider Cat's position, I couldn't pick a side because there was no side, right?
Yeah.
There's Beetle who handled this masterfully. And then there's Cat, who, by all accounts, should have a much better life than Beetle, even though Beetle's life is pretty great. But she has such an abusive mentor, such a terrible, terrible aunt, that even though it's not physical abuse, it is physical abuse.
And like, I think that's one of the key points. Like, I feel like as a 12-year-old reading this, this would be very important, this message that, like, abuse is not... It's not always just physical. There's other ways that people abuse you. And the aunt is a clear example of that. Although it does get kind of physical at the end.
Because she's literally like stealing her life force. She's draining it out of her. But for most of this comic book, Kat is struggling with obeying her aunt. Because she knows that she can lose her position and lose her space in the school that will teach her magic. And then her family will get mad at her and everything will break down and go terribly wrong. So she stays with this aunt who other adults believe, right? Because she's very powerful and Kat is a prodigy. And there's a lot there that we fully understand why she is staying there. Because it would be difficult to leave that position. But
and I think we've all been in situations like that in our lives. You know, like everyone ends up in a situation where they're like, it's sad. Maybe not everyone, but I have, I guess. And I think a lot of people have situations where they probably shouldn't be in there, but, you know, they feel like they need to because, I don't know, either they're getting something important for their career out of it or their lives depend on it on some level and it sucks.
Or even just it's going to be more uncomfortable in the moment to get out of that situation than to stay in it.
Yeah.
Even though that moment of discomfort will be fairly quick and then it will be over, right? But it's still,
I mean, that can be terrifying. It's just that moment.
It's very difficult. Yeah. Especially if there are some stakes to it, especially if there's like personal safety, which here it is something that she has to consider.
Yeah.
Because,
that's true.
Because by that point in the comic, we're just thinking, okay, she can just leave. She's just scared to do it. But then we realize that, no, she's literally tethered to this woman who can kill her.
Yeah.
If she messes with her plans in any way that has substance to it, Kat will be killed.
Yeah.
And
can I mention, because I'm thinking a cat and her heart that like stores her like essence in it. Can I just say, I want to see more books where one of the main characters is a lich, because that was, I really like having a lich for a main character.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, liches are awesome. Like, I don't know. I just want to see more liches and everything. Just my little
necromancers. I love when
necromancer,
like,
make your own friends, right?
Exactly. I love when tropes like that are turned around. Yes.
Until the day I die, and then I'm resurrected. And then I can make that joke some more with my funny bones. Ha ha ha. Oh God, that was really bad.
I'm leaving that in the main podcast because that was really good.
So, liches. No.
Okay, I think I have kind of like one last comment, because we didn't talk about
Blob, Penny.
Blob ghost.
Blob ghost. Blob boast.
There's kind of like a lot to do with plot and that character, but not so much about the ghost itself. I really like the friendship that Beetle and Blob have. But what I do appreciate is how it ended, right? It was such a hopeful high note. And then we have this little ghost who has kind of no identity or memory of who they used to be.
Yeah.
Discovering and first of all giving themselves I don't remember if
themselves they used they them
okay and giving themselves a name that they felt comfortable with, right? Maybe possibly a name that they used to have, because that seems to be their tether. But regardless of that, right, like, to have this book where these two characters have been struggling with self-identity, and on a character who seems to have not really been that worried about it on the surface, but whose entire journey had to do with saving themselves and who they are, discover that. I don't know. It was just like, it could have ended with just them, just Beetle and Cat going to magic school with the skeleton, right? That would have been fine. And the ghost could have just been hanging out there. But to have the ghost name themselves in the end, it just did that little extra step for me.
Yeah.
That I really, really enjoyed. And all of these creators are so cool. They craft such cool stories.
I don't know anything about this specific... I don't know. I know she's a Tumblr person.
Yeah. After I read this, I immediately followed her on Tumblr.
I'm looking her up right now. Okay, so there's going to be sequels.
Oh, interesting.
Beetle sequels coming 2024 and 2025. Dang.
Nice.
We got some... That is a long lead time, though. Like, usually, you know, if they're announcing a new book, they...
Is it, like, a big announcement or just, like, a...
It's on our website. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
The next book will be called Beetle and the Chimera Carnival.
Nice. Got some series of unfortunate events vibes. Just because there's a carnival in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
nothing else.
I was going to say, like, I'm trying to think about what the other series.
A very huge show.
Okay. I'm like, is there a count? No. Is there? I don't know. Well, maybe that's a good note. Like, talking about the sequel is a good note to end on. Mm-hmm. Thank you all so much for tuning into this wide-ranging and breathful discussion of Beetle and the Hollow Bone by Eliza Lane. I just wanted to plug our social media. We have a Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. They are all at InMediaLez. We have a subreddit, is r/InMediaLez. You can email us at inmedialez@gmail.com. And finally, we have a website, inmedialez.com. If you have a question or comment and would like to have us featured on the show, just say that that's okay and we'd be happy to. And finally, our website is inmedialez.com. Please like, subscribe, share, review this episode. Anything you can do would be really helpful. You know, we're just a small show, so those small things really help us out. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Give us recommendations. That would be lovely.
Yes.
Find us the non-binary characters.
Yes. And if there's something like near and dear to your heart that you want us to discuss, please just let us know. Even anything at all, we'd be happy to cover. Thank you so much and have a good one.
We'll see you in the next one.
It was a stupid day for me. I went out and did some shopping in Manhattan, and part of the reason was because Sarah left something at my apartment. And I
when you guys made Becky's Eldritch monster creation in...
Yes, when she became the monster in Elden Ring, which is a new strategy. Like, you could play as a human who is going to win, or you could just make a monster and therefore be powerful from the start. And Becky chose the latter option.